Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Wednesday, April 20th, 2005. We are hearing House Bill 5022, the district attorneys and their deputies. We will hear, first of all, from Doug Wilson, Legislative Fiscal Office, followed by Linda Gilbert from Budget and Management Division, and then Bob Herman, Washington County District Attorney, followed by Tim Callahan, Harney County District Attorney. And all of that will be followed by public testimony. We are opening without a quorum. I do expect Senator Devlin to arrive a little later, and as far as I know, Representative Hansen will be joining us as well. Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, there's a memo in your packet or on the, underneath the agenda. Real quickly, this is one of our phase two or phase one and two memos. The agency, in this case, there is an agency called district attorneys and their deputies, but there are 36 managers in this agency and no staff. This is sort of partial or totally in jest here, but district attorneys are state employees. The 36 district attorneys are state employees. They're compensated by the state, but all their employees, deputy district attorneys and other staff, investigators, support staff, are county employees. Generally, they'll go through the agency mission and their program customers. In terms of budget notes, audit findings, there were no audits done, no audit reports or findings in this agency. There was one budget note last year or last session dealing with compensation of district attorneys, and that was reported to the emergency board, I believe it was last November. And I'm sure there'll be discussion about that because there's a package in the budget related to that. On the second page, on the back side, this is an agency, all the general fund. I just show your attention to the graph that shows the funding over the last three biennia plus the one that's in the governor's recommended budget. You'll notice actually the budget has not changed all that much in terms of the total amount, but the distribution has changed, where in 9901 that the state assisted counties and the DAs in witness fees, that money has totally disappeared, as well as the amount provided to counties and district attorney offices for deputy DA supplements has been reduced significantly. Part of that is most of that is due to the problems during 0103, as well as the ballot measure 30 cuts and the roll up those cuts from last biennium into this biennium. In terms of major policy and budget issues, the roll up costs that affected the deputy DA supplements, and then the compensation issues. The Department of Administrative Services reported to the e-board and recommended that the sort of the distribution of DAs change. Currently, there are four groups based on population for the most part. The report to the e-board discussed a change in that that talked about moving four counties based on population into the top group or the highest compensated group, one county from group three to group two, and that would have had a cost of roughly $162,000. The governor's recommended budget takes that one step further and combines the second and third group. That will be discussed, I'm sure, in more detail. And the cost of that is $492,000. Madam Chair, just some administrative note here. I think the agenda, or not the agenda, but the schedule calls says there may be a work session. It is not my intent, or am I ready for a work session on this budget? And I'll put this out right now. Anyone wishing to testify needs to sign up unless you're already on the agenda. So during public testimony, if you plan to testify, please sign up on this.
And Mr. Wilson, while we are not ready for a work session today, and that was my understanding as well, would you please comment on the co-chair's treatment of this area of the budget?
The one issue that the co-chairs looked at, and they were additions to the essential budget level, was the pay or the compensation package that in the governor's budget was $492,000, all general fund. The co-chairs on both sides did not include that in their budget.
And I'm going to call on Ms. Gilbert next. Linda Gilbert, good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. We are working from this document. This will be a high-level budget overview for the district attorneys and the deputies. On the second page, we have the usual two pie charts showing their portion of the all funds budget and their portion of the general fund budget. They are all general funded. Of the all funds $2.4 billion public safety program area budget, they are 0.4 or 0.4% at $9.6 million. With respect to general fund and lottery fund public safety budget, which totals $1.6 billion, the district attorneys use 0.6% of that amount. The next two pages will go very fast because they are single-piece pies. On page three, this is the budget by fund type, and as was stated before, there is one fund type, general fund, supporting the entire budget, $9.6 million. On the following page, this is budget by program unit, and this is one program, general program. It funds, as you've seen already in Mr. Wilson's display, the salaries for the district attorneys, some deputy supplement amount of money, and some funding for administrative support. On page five, we have the budget by budget category. The largest portion, 83%, or $7 million, about $8 million rounded, is in personal services, the salaries and other personnel expenditures for the district attorneys. The deputy supplement is in special payments at the top. That's 7% of the budget at $701,874. And finally, they have a services and supplies budget of $938,619, which is 10% of the budget. On page six, we'll see in numbers what Mr. Wilson presented in graph form, which is the 9901 through 0507 history of this budget. It has clearly it fell in two biennia. It's 3.6% higher now than the 0305 legislatively approved budget. Most of that is because of the inclusion of the salary package in other places. Costs went down. And on page 7, talking about major policy issues, this budget assumes the structure change for the compensation, and this is a package that will be discussed more later. It also assumes, as Mr. Wilson has said, no witness fee supplements to counties. Cost drivers are salary and other personnel expense inflation for the most part. On the final page, there are no fee or revenue issues, and there are no technical adjustments anticipated. And that concludes my overview.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Comments or questions? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For both of our experts here, how the heck did we ever get in this situation? Why are we funding a county district attorney, not the deputies? I mean, I don't understand how you run a railroad this way. I mean,
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, actually, I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and look at the history. Maybe during the presentation, if one of the district attorneys knows what the history is, I'd have to go back. I've done this for a number of years.
Madam Chair, I follow up. I love my state, my new state, but I don't know how we get into some of these predicaments we get in that we're having to. States having to fund the district attorney, and they're upset because they haven't got pay raises, and we're funding some counties with deputies and not other counties. And just it's not the way it's not the way it's just like we have now in the school system where we're, you know, we've got the local school boards deciding raises and we have to give the money to the teachers and to the health benefits and all that. It's a strange way to run a railroad.
Madam Chair, Representative Woodsmith, make sure that, you know, we don't necessarily in any way with the deputies provide counties, you know, we provide them roughly a proportional share. It's based on the number of deputy DAs they have. So in that sense, the counties are treated fairly in that amount. We don't give an unfair amount to one county and not any to another county for the deputy DAs. There's a formula that's used for that.
Well, Representative, picking up on your language, I know that they're looking in at the room. There is definitely experience in the room that can help us understand how the railroad has been run.
Have one, Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Well, I guess, and you know, are we going to get data about how much the district attorneys are paid? When's the last time they were given raises? Or is because of the. The governor's proposed an increase, but then our co-chairs have not. So, and I'm sure all of us have been called by our district attorney saying support the.
Representative, if you want that history, I'm sure that that history will be provided to you and to the committee.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, if I may.
Certainly,
and representatives. The governor, in supporting this package, was supporting a restructuring of the compensation schedule that the district attorneys have. They were paid in four different tiers, and it was depending on population. So that when DAS, Human Resource Services Division, got together with the Oregon District Attorneys Association to look at this, in accordance with the budget note that they got last time, DAS simply did what had been done before, which was to say, given population changes, this is where the four breaks would be. But because they were meeting with the District Attorneys Association and because restructuring to meet, to match, to get salary closer to matching workload was something that had been important to the district attorneys, that was their recommendation or their desire out of this. When DAS went to the emergency board in November, there was no recommendation. It was a report of findings. And so it found what DAS HRSD had found in four tiers and found what the district attorneys had proposed in three tiers. After that, the governor did recommend. So we get into the semantics of a report and a recommendation. When the governor recommended the restructuring, it was something he had been interested in since he was attorney general.
I have one last question.
Certainly.
Thank you. Now, I guess I'm a common sense person. I understand what we're doing here is we're trying. Some counties are small, have little workload, and that's the base. And then we're tearing up and giving other counties. But I don't understand why we couldn't just give every county a base, and everything else is the county's responsibility. I mean, I don't understand why we're getting. I still don't understand why we're funding district attorneys from the state, county district attorneys, because I understand small counties. You got to have a district attorney in the county, and it's hard for them to pay, and they've got to represent the state and the people, and I understand all that. And so we're giving them the minimum, and we're coming around to counties that are larger, that have more money, and we're giving them more. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, this does go back in history further back than I am familiar with, but there are certified smart people in this room who will be able to talk about that.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen?
Well, if I could jump in on that. One of the problems that you've got in terms of trying to equalize is the incredible variety of counties that we've got. And we've got three that with about 1,500 population that have, I would assume, unless the 1,500 are real wild. It's a relatively low work, less than very part-time responsibility. And then you've got Multnomah County at the top, which is a significant 70 deputies or a very large law firm size. One of the reasons the counties have always felt that the state should be giving a larger share, and proportionately, we fund the small counties pretty well, the very small counties. But by the time you get to the bigger counties, it's a pretty minor contribution. And yet, 95% of the work they're doing is in terms of enforcing state legislation, state laws, working in state courts. It's pretty easy to look at it as being a lot of a statewide function.
Thank you.
But I wasn't here for the start back in 1858.
Thank you very much, Representative Hansen, and thank you, Ms. Gilbert. I appreciate your help this afternoon. And I'm going to call up Mr. Herman and Mr. Callahan. If you'd like to come together, I think there's enough room there for both of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney in Washington County and am serving this year as president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. For those of you that might have expected to see Brad Berry in my place, I did too as of a couple weeks ago. He has been our budget man and our legislative chair, but he is doing district attorney duties, finishing attempted murder kidnapping trial in Yamhill County in closing arguments today, so I'm here in his place. I hope through our presentation, Representative Wisdom, we can answer some of those questions that you've posed. I'm going to focus primarily on through some slides on an overview of the of district attorneys throughout the state. Mr. Callahan will speak to some specific budget issues, and then there's a number of district attorneys from around the state that are here today to maybe answer some questions that we can't, and to provide some further help to the committee.
Mr. Herman, I'm going to apologize to the audience that the screen is positioned in such a way that you're unable to see the presentation.
This will follow the handouts that are on the table, hopefully. I confess that despite being from the Silicon Forest, this is the first PowerPoint I've used, so...
Let me also ask that as you're making the presentation, Mr. Herman and Mr. Callahan, one of the subjects that we're all deeply concerned about, this committee and every legislator, the methamphetamine epidemic, how that's impacting Oregon communities. And if at some point in your presentation you can address how that epidemic translates to work in your agencies, increases in caseload, anything else that you would want to share with us that helps us understand your evolving work, that would be most helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will do that. The Oregon District Attorney's authority basically was created by the Oregon Constitution. The Constitution, when drafted, said the district attorney shall be elected by districts comprised of one or more counties, a sufficient number of prosecuting attorneys who shall be the law officers of the state and the counties within their respective districts. So we draw our authority from the Oregon State Constitution. Chapter 8 of the Oregon Revised Statutes gives us our primary charge of responsibilities, which basically are broken down into the obvious, the prosecution of public offenses or crimes within our respective counties. The mandate that we are to give priority to laws relating to public assistance and basically child support enforcement collection, which I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know in our county is about $31 million of collections a year, and each county is charged with that responsibility. And also, the district attorney is mandated through Chapter 8 to assist the juvenile court by appearing in that court, and typically that involves assisting the juvenile department with hearings on delinquency or crime violations by juveniles. Of note is the practice... most every district attorney's office in the state. We also provide support for DHS the second phase of juvenile hearings are what we call dependency hearings, and Chair Gordley mentioned the methamphetamine problem. We always had dependency hearings before methamphetamine, but believe me, we have a great deal more of them now. We in our county, and forgive me if I refer to my county some because I have the statistics readily at hand, but I know this is a case statewide, but we're 75 to 80 to 90% of our dependency cases are affected in some way by meth. That means we're dealing with children who need the help of the assistance of the system of the court for their protection, and somehow methamphetamine is related in the abuse, the neglect, or the factors there. And I make this point simply that that's not a mandated function under Oregon law. We could pull out. I think some counties have been forced to pull out because of resources. They don't have the resources to provide help in that area. But the practical matter is we need to have prosecutors to help in those dependency cases so those kids are protected. And so a lot of people do it as a result of that.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In human resources today, we had a discussion with DHS over their proposal to involve the Attorney General in their dependency hearings. And an idea just to float would, and this is a fairly costly proposal, and I believe the District Attorney's Association has endorsed it. Would it be possible for DHS to contract with county district attorneys instead of the Attorney General's office to provide that same level of support? And would that be maybe more efficient based on the fact that you're often involved in those cases already from maybe some criminal charges or negligence or some other things that are surrounding the case?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, that actually topic has been discussed with the Attorney General's office and DHS in terms of their proposal. I think it's fair to say that we would certainly be willing to sit down, you know, at the table to discuss the options. There are certainly areas where DHS needs representation that we can't provide because we, in fact, have a conflict in terms of what they may be seeking and what we may be seeking. There are gaps even beyond what we can provide, and they could provide, quite frankly. But I guess the best answer is to say we'd certainly be willing to sit down with all the parties and discuss that issue.
Representative Hanson, did you?
I'm done.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have an idea, and I'm not going to hold you to it, but just some idea of what percent of the cases that DHS brings to juvenile court that you actually represent one of the children? You represent the children, and what percent of their cases do you think? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, the many times it's the juvenile system is a little bit the correct word, but we don't. Oftentimes, there's a private attorney or a public defender appointed for the child, but we typically believe that we are representing the child's interest as well. So there's a number of attorneys there, and then there's attorneys for both. One or both of the parents involved. So just to make that distinction, we're not the child's attorney typically.
Let me interrupt you just for a minute because I'm not in the legal system. So just because being from the district attorney's office, you just kind of, or you do have authority to represent the child's interest. That's what we're trying to unpack is, if you're there representing the child's interest, then why are we bringing another group in, or what's the necessity to bring another group in to say that you're not doing it or can't do it?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, try to give you an example, and I'm sure sometime later I can be corrected by some of my colleagues if they disagree, but a child is removed from the home because of an abuse situation, and so a petition is filed in juvenile court that alleges that the child is in need of the protection of the state because of this abusive situation. The court will then typically appoint an attorney to represent the parents, but then we'll appoint an attorney to represent the child and the child's specific interests, And then Department of Human Services, on behalf of the state, will be a party as well. And we often appear with their same interests. As they may say that we believe this child should be placed in foster care or with a grandparent or make some particular recommendation. Many times the alignment of what the child's attorney and the DHS says is the same, but it may be the child's attorney says, you know, this child's 16, I'm representing that she wants to go back to this environment. Although many times we're on, you know, we're on board with the child's attorney, there can be a difference in interests. And what happens, and it varies, and others can tell you from, depending upon the size of the county and the resources the counties have available, there are cases where there is no attorney, and in some cases, representing Department of Human Services. There's no one there to make that call. In my county, we are typically there at their request to make the case, present the evidence, and that's been a topic of concern. Some judges have ordered the state to provide someone, even though it's not legally mandated. The judge says, be there, you know, you're there, but it's a...
Madam Chair, follow up?
Please continue.
So, because some of the testimony we have taken on the DHS side of the, in my other committee we're hearing, would be that in that specific case that you discussed, the child would be there with a DHS social worker, in effect, somewhat handling the legal side of things, and without the DAs being there, you know, the risk of them, you know, attempting legal work when they're not really qualified to do so. Is that the case?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, that can be, and I think Mr. Cohan, from the perspective of Harney County, can speak to that as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, my name is Tim Clohan, District Attorney in Harney County. I can give you a perspective from a, obviously a much smaller county than Washington County. I guess perhaps to clarify, District Attorney's role in a dependency case, we do not represent the child. We actually represent the juvenile department. We do not represent DHS, and that addresses one of the inherent potential conflicts that District Attorney Herman was talking about, where DHS is present. There is not an attorney general present representing them, but the district attorney is there representing the juvenile department, and that can cause problems. But it's clear, and I think the committee needs to understand that in these cases, normally there is an attorney represented or appointed for the child. Frequently, there's an attorney represented for the parents. The DA is there to represent the juvenile department. DHS, at least in my county, is present, but they are not represented.
Madam Chair, will you indulge us for a little bit on this? This is
certainly.
We had this conversation, and as Representative Hanson and I are both on both committees, this is important to understand.
Absolutely.
And who would have appointed the attorney in the scenario you used? Who would have appointed the attorney for the child?
And
typically, where would they have come from? From what entity would they come from?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, Hanna, the attorney for the child would have been appointed by the circuit court. And that would come either from the through a contract or through an injured defense provider.
So, Madam Chair, follow up. So, for instance, you said Harney County, correct? In Harney County, that would be a contracted attorney for Department of Justice?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, no, it would not be through the Department of Justice. That would be through a private, either through an indigent defense provider who has a contract with the Department of
The Judicial Department.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. Please continue.
Thank you. The mission of the Oregon District Attorney is reflected as well in our guiding principles.
Madam Chair, if you turn back in the document after the blue page, you'll pick up the presentation documents.
Each district attorney, no matter the size of the county, is guided by these principles: to uphold the U.S. Constitution and the laws of Oregon, and to preserve the safety of the public. That's kind of our bedrock kind of where we start in terms of protecting the public, upholding the laws, and that involves typically the prosecution of persons who are alleged to commit crimes within the boundaries of the county. We also are charged with protecting the rights of crime victims and treating them with dignity. And that, I think, virtually all the full-time district attorney's offices in the state now have a victim's person or persons to perform our duty with the to the crime victims that we deal with.
May I stop you there just for a moment?
Sure.
Representative Hannah.
Please bear with me, Madam Chair. I have one more question related to the last issue, and this could be to either of you. In the cases you described where an attorney had been appointed to represent the child for DHS, would the child's caseworker, would the person who is handling the child from the DHS side also be present?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, the DHS caseworker who is assigned to that case would be present in court. But once again, at least in my county, and I know in many counties in the state, there frequently is not an assistant attorney general there to represent that caseworker or DHS.
Once more, Madam Chair. So in the case currently where in any county a child ends up in court, the caseworker is with the child and they do not get representation, just for whatever reason, it wasn't a serious enough case, or there was nobody available because in the case of DHS they've been sending social workers to be with many of the children during their court case. Would there be a case where you would see a substitute? I mean, in other words, used to be that the caseworker came with the child to every one of the court hearings. Now you plug in somebody from the legal side who's appointed by DHS to represent them legally. Are you separating out that caseworker from being there?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I guess I don't want to make it even more complicated, but there's actually another person who's involved also, and that is the court-appointed special advocate, the CASA worker.
Mm-hmm.
And just to clarify my comment, the caseworker is there representing DHS. The caseworker obviously is there to represent the best interests of the child in planning, but the attorney who is representing the child does not obviously represent DHS. DHS is present and will inform the court as to the circumstances that brought the child into the jurisdiction of the court. But you've got competing interests there between the Attorney General's office, who's there if they are present for DHS, and the attorney that's been appointed for the child.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
I
Wilson?
Think when Department of Justice presented some of their information on this package, and from my recollection from some past experiences of mine, DHS is represented by attorneys or the Attorney General's office in like 5% or less of the cases presently, and the package that they have, I think, increases that to like maybe 15% of the cases, if I remember right. So to put some perspective, DHS in those cases where it's a significant issue and there are significant legal issues will call upon justice to represent them, but it's in very few cases because of, you know, basically financial constraints at this time.
Madam Chair, where this gets confusing, obviously, is the representation, and it's also, again, to the testimony that we've taken on the human services side of things, where representation could potentially eliminate up to 44 positions from the caseworker side. So I'm trying to decide, just because you give legal representation, does that mean that the caseworker isn't going to be needed there? And so I hope you'll understand. We're just trying to figure out how this works.
This is very good. Our goal is to achieve the fullest possible understanding of all of these issues. So feel free to continue to ask questions.
It's been very helpful. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Mr. Herman?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hannah. In hopes of not confusing the issue further, but one thing that comes to light that you've heard about the legal, different legal representations. what frequently happens is child's removed from the home, DHS, the social worker, has a position that in the best interest of the child they should be placed in a different environment. And most of the time the deputy district attorney working with the case is in agreement with that plan, and so we in effect as a practical matter end up advocating, even though I said representing DHS, we're legally representing the juvenile department, we many times end up on the same, you know, exactly the same page and feel like we are representing DHS because we agree with the plan. There are occasions, however, where I can think of an example where DHS says we think the child should be put back in the environment, and we as the DA's office say, you know, we don't think so, and that's where your conflict comes in, because they have no one representing them, and we are taking a position, and the child's attorney may be taking a, you know, a third position. So I hope that makes some sense. Moving on with the with our guiding principles, of course, pursuing justice for all citizens with skill, honor, and integrity. And I would say that, again, it makes no difference in what county you are in being a representative and the chief law enforcement officer of your community. The role of the district attorney is extremely important. How he or she conducts his business, how he or she is perceived with doing their job fairly and with justice, it makes us all really equal partners in our job to generate the respect for the system that we hope all the citizens feel from the work we're doing. So a malfeasance act by a district attorney in Kearney County affects us all in terms of our faith in the justice system. A couple of other guiding principles that I think are very important and really have evolved over the course of time with the resources in Oregon, with the growth in population, with the methamphetamine problems and other problems we've seen. Guiding principle is to seek effective and efficient administration of justice. Effective and efficient. We don't just prosecute cases anymore, and I'll get to some specifics a little bit later on, but district attorneys throughout the state in each county are really charged with being leaders, being innovative, and being players in order to make sure that the system is effective and efficient from a cost standpoint, and I'll get to those specifics. And finally, along those same lines, we value partnerships with stakeholders in the community, and again, I guess no news is good news. If you don't hear much about the district attorney, that usually means they haven't done something controversial. There's not a major case going on, but that doesn't suggest that the importance of being connected to the community and the stakeholders is any different in, you know, our smallest counties and our largest counties. There are 33 full-time district attorneys presently in the state of Oregon and 3 part-time district attorneys, and although none of the district attorneys here, the part-time from Gilliam, Sherman, and Wheeler counties are here today, I can guarantee you that if given the opportunity, they would explain why their role is part-time is a very false assumption, because basically they work full-time at what they do and keep busy trying to maintain their duties and responsibilities. Again, the organizational chart is simply to emphasize that each district attorney is independently elected, which makes us kind of a unique state agency, if you will. We're elected by our own voters, subject to the recall or the decisions of our own voters within our county. It's not to suggest that we're disorganized. We have an organization that works together to try to work for the good of the citizens of the state of Oregon and to educate ourselves, to pass on information, and to work in a variety of ways. But ultimately, this is a kind of a unique agency in that respect. This is simply what you've seen before, is the governor's recommended budget and how it's divided really into three parts. And again, the priorities are salaries, which have been mandated by state law, deputy district attorney supplements, and those supplements go to, I believe, of the full-time district attorneys, 32 have deputy DAs. Lake County is hoping to put together, as I understand it, a federal grant and supplements from the DA's budget to perhaps hire a deputy DA, but there are roughly at any given time 350 to 360 deputy DAs. We have a formula, but that's basically who shares the $701,000, and it's a small amount, and I won't get into the details, but the formula basically is you, everybody gets the same amount for the first three if you have three, and then it goes into percentages so that Multnomah County or Washington County, because we have more district deputy district attorneys, doesn't get, you know, an inordinate share of the amount. And I'm sure the DAs from the less populous counties can tell you the extreme significance to their budget of even those amounts of deputy district attorney supplements and then services and supplies. District attorneys throughout the state interact with many, many groups, and I won't prolong the presentation by going through every group, but what is important, I believe, to emphasize is, again, no matter the size of the county, the importance of interaction of the district attorney, the chief law enforcement officer, with those members of the community is really critical to the delivery of justice and the delivery of services. We deal with, of course, citizens and witnesses who get a perception of justice through their bumping into the court system, if you will. Community members, citizen jurors, and people that put on jury service, it's often very rewarding to have them give me a call and say, you know, I was really impressed with the professionalism of your office or your attorney. That's where their impressions come from, you know, what they see, how justice is served, and how we're doing our job, and quite frankly, how taxpayer dollars are being spent, be it state or county. Schools, district attorneys interact with schools in a variety of different ways. It certainly depends on the population. Often district attorneys and their deputies are in the schools talking to classes from an educational standpoint. It's not mandated, but it's a role that is proved valuable with the advent of ballot measure 11, the advent of a number of things. Educating our youth about how the process works and how things can affect them has proved to be a valuable tool. Recently, again, if you bear with me, as an example from Washington County, the Beaverton School District was having a problem with the enforcement of restraining orders. Judges were ordering restraining orders. You couldn't have contact with your spouse except at school events, and that was causing some significant problems for the schools at sporting events or other type of social events. And we basically worked with the school district, brought it to our attention, to my office's attention. We worked with our judges and staff to revise the restraining order process so they recognized how that was impacting the school districts. And that's just one example, but certainly there's interaction there. Federal agencies, very important interactions. Gun control has worked with the PSN, Project Safe Neighborhood Grants, has worked with a number of counties and organizations to try to deal with the issue of not gun control, that's a bad word, the issue of illegal use of guns and how they're impacting the community. We work with the drug agencies and attempt to work with a lot of agencies because we deal locally with problems that sometimes the federal government can help us with their resources and expertise. Sometimes I guess we can help them. For example, district attorneys will be charged with prosecuting a bank robbery case, which is under federal jurisdiction, if the federal government doesn't choose to prosecute it. Although our relationships have gotten better over the years, if a crime occurs in a county, that's our responsibility, even if the federal government may have an ability to come in and do it, they may choose not to. That's a reality we have to face. Sometimes we don't always agree with it, but drug cases are a classic example. They may take a drug case, they may not, but again, that's a the working relationship, and a good one with those agencies, is very critical to a good use of resources and an effective means to the ends of justice. Indigent defense, it goes without saying, sometimes, and because it's an adversarial system, what's most commonly heard are the disagreements between prosecution and indigent defense. The reality is, again, I know in my county, and I think it's fairly consistent across the state, less than 4% of the criminal cases charged actually end up in trial. Even in a population of Washington County, we have 500 to 600 trials a year, which is not very much in terms of the total number. So it means there's a needed relationship between the parties to in resolving the cases and to do it as efficiently and effectively as possible. And I don't know if Peter Roseanne is in fact here today. We've sat down as representatives of our agencies to discuss continued ways that we can find efficiencies. And I would simply say that having a good district attorney, whatever size your county, is very important to the good of the state, to make sure that those partnerships are worked effectively. The medical community, I don't want to dwell too much on these things, but we work, you may have heard of SANE and SART, the sexual assault response teams, and SANE and sexual assault nurse teams, which through the coordination of the Attorney General and district attorneys and victim advocates around the state working together, there's an ongoing developing a process where a rape victim now, and going back to my old days, 30 years as a prosecutor, who may often wait in the emergency room at then Holiday Park Hospital for 8 hours before being seen by a doctor for an examination. Nurses are being trained. There's a cooperative effort so that those victims can be seen separately by trained nurse and staff and treated respectfully. The evidence can be gathered and they can be they can move on. And again, I don't begin to suggest this is the district attorneys only, but we are partners in this process with training statewide. And it's perhaps the smaller communities may even get more value out of this because they have less facilities or resources to draw upon. You've heard about juvenile court. Many district attorneys are involved in a peer court, which is an offshoot of juvenile court, where the cases don't process through the juvenile court. They, through the cooperation of local district attorneys, they basically have a process where peers decide their fate, their guilt, and then their fate, and that both save resources and it's a good way to go. The Oregon State Hospital, there are, as you undoubtedly know, in the criminal justice system, there may be a guilty but insane defense that's changed its names over the years, but there's a separate wing of those with mental health issues that may not be involved on the criminal side of things. Those are processes where there's a review process. If a person is sentenced to the state hospital, there's a review process that district attorneys are at least indirectly involved in. They're indirectly involved up front. And I might mention that this is a further example of a major concern for counties in terms of cost, because as methamphetamine and other drugs have started to impact the population, we're seeing certainly more people that are have diagnosable mental illnesses than we used to see. And it's very important that those cases are processed effectively. And unfortunately, the cost now, we're getting more bills from the state hospital for their evaluations. And in our county, we're choosing to have to not call an expert in some cases because we can't afford to. And so we have to try to use our advocacy to do so without an expert, without getting into a lot of detail. But that's a very important area that district attorneys need to effectively work. And I jump down to mental health agencies because they tie together both in the regard to mental illnesses that may have some cause for a person that's in the criminal justice system, as well as drug courts and drug affected individuals. It is a very important role, and quite frankly, from my years as a district attorney, we were never connected to mental health agencies. We're far more connected now and should be. And it again, from county to county to county, that's very important to make sure that we can marshal the resources and cooperate in a manner so that those cases are properly dealt with either in or outside the criminal justice system.
Mr. Herman, I have a question for you related to the Oregon State Hospital and the mental health agency connection. As you're aware, there is a work group looking at possible closure of the Oregon State Hospital, moving patients into community-based situations, and that group, that work group, all of that is coming out of a concern held by the Senate President and many legislators about treatment of patients at the state hospital. Fast forward here. Is your association involved at all with that work group as it looks at the future for the forensic side of the hospital and those forensic patients and where they would eventually be housed, treated, should the hospital close? Are your interests being represented in that work group?
Madam Chair, and if I might, I'll look over my shoulder to make sure I'm correct. I'm not seeing any faces of recognition because I'm not aware that we are aware of that work group. I can tell you we would have a very significant interest in the issues, particularly on the forensic side, because that is near and dear to our ability to process cases.
I would encourage you to be in touch with Bob Nickel, Mr. Bob Nickel, Department of Human Services, Office of Mental Health and Drug Addiction Services, who has a role in coordinating that effort. I'm calling it a work group. It's got some other name. But again, as you're speaking, it just occurs to me that there is an interest that should be represented, heard. By that work group, again, as it relates to the forensic side.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will pursue that. Offenders, community corrections, parole and probation. We actually deal with offenders in different ways in our role as district attorneys. Won't get into specifics. Community corrections, parole, and probation. We do the probation revocation hearings. We work very closely with those departments and their resources. Department of Justice, we work very closely with. They work very closely with us in training, prosecution of a number of cases. Some of these are obvious crime victims organizations. Legislative Assembly, quite frankly, this is my 30 years of prosecution. This is the first time I've been down to the Capitol so many times in this particular session. And although it should have been obvious to me before, it's much more apparent to me now that it behooves district attorneys throughout the state to be involved in the legislative process to both give our perspective of things and to perhaps provide some of the specifics and information about, you know, what we do and how everything relates. And I know some of us are geographically challenged, and it's much easier for poor Walt Bigelow to come across the street than it is for Ann Norris to drive from Malheur County. But nonetheless, it's an important role of district attorneys. And again, it's part of my theme today, if you will, that no matter how big or small, we are important to the state system, even though we're funded primarily by the county. We interact with volunteers. Many district attorney's offices are that's how we supplement a lot of our budget, is we have people in our victims programs, volunteers that provide a lot of community support for us. And these are things that you won't find listed, because as I was driving down here, I'm thinking of those. And of course, law enforcement is probably obvious, but the role of the district attorney, and my predecessor once said, well, we're not paid to give them legal advice. And that's true, we're not. But we're paid to uphold the laws of the state and the Constitution. And the reality is that we deal with the work of the police officers. So the more educated, the more informed they are in terms of the law. We review search warrants. Most of the time, nobody writes a search warrant apparently during the day, so it's in the middle of the night. But we provide support to police agencies and multiple trainings so that the citizens are protected, their rights are protected, and as a reality, our cases are protected in that the evidence is seized properly, the admissions, Mirandas, and so forth are administered properly, and so that we can do our job properly. But and one other thing that comes to mind in terms of interactions, it's kind of combined with this, but it's a committee that the Chief Justice chairs, the Criminal Justice Advisory Committee, that both Bradbury and myself are members, and it's a committee comprised of all sorts of components of the criminal justice system. But again, it kind of illustrates the importance of the district attorney's role to other agencies that are funded most primarily by the state, and that's the courts and indigent defense. It's that working together, it sounds somewhat trite, but working together, it's amazing, even if you have adversarial positions, how much can be accomplished. And on the worksheet right now is a system, subcommittee chaired by Judge Franz from Multnomah County is working on a best practices for the court system, recognizing all judges are independently elected. That in itself, as we are sometimes reminded, they are independently elected, but we're working on a number of suggestions that would suggest if the court system cases proceed in this manner and they're managed in such a manner, it will be more efficient and it will cost less because cases will be resolved efficiently and more quickly. There's a number of things coming out of that committee. In fact, Craig Prinz from Criminal Justice may have presented already, but there was the discovery that information that goes into a uniform judgment that the courts are preparing may be able to be drawn by his committee instead of filling out separate forms, causing extra work and so forth. So,
Do district attorneys receive any of their training through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training?
None that I'm aware of, Madam Chair, none that I'm aware of.
Is there any other role that DAs play with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training?
Madam Chair, actually, I think the reverse is true. Some district attorneys teach and basically teach at the, and have over the years taught there. I'm not aware of further connections.
Speaking of that role, do any of the district attorneys or the association provide training for the Oregon State Police? Is there that link? Yes.
Madam Chair, Mr. Schrunk nods yes, so I'm assuming that is the case. Locally, I can tell you locally, we have not much of a presence of the state police in Washington County anymore, but locally we provide training and DUII and so forth for officers, and I'm sure from county to county, particularly where that law enforcement agency is a staple in their county, that there's that same interaction that I mentioned before, in terms of training, practice procedures and so forth that goes on.
Mm-hmm. What's behind my questions is the need to better understand who is providing what training amongst our public safety / judicial partners? Where's the collaboration? Where are there opportunities to better coordinate? And so that's what's behind that particular question. But please continue.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd say probably the best way to put it is we fill in the gaps, which once they get back to our county, in my county there's 12 police agencies of varying sizes and expertise, so we attempt to fill in the gaps. I've already mentioned program delivery, but one thing that I didn't even know, district attorney is here today from Crook County, you must have counted them up, but there's over 300 statutes that mandate responsibilities for district attorneys statewide, and it doesn't make a distinction between the size of the county. Included amongst those are public records requests. It's kind of an odd historical perspective, but if a news media, or typically a news media or citizen, wants a public record and has been denied such access to such, it's the district attorney's responsibility, much as a judge, to review and rule on that process. And I can tell you from personal experience that takes some time. And again, it makes no difference how big you are, how many people you have. That's a responsibility DAs have. We're also, under statute, really co-in charge of death investigations with a medical examiner. That often translates into calls again in the middle of the night and responding to scenes in terms of criminal investigations. But in some district attorney's office, they actually house the budget of the deputy medical examiners that serve. And depending, again, upon the size of the county, your responsibilities could be greater in a smaller county, for example. And, again, referring to my county, we have 3 deputy medical examiners, and we're in close proximity to the state medical examiner's office. So in a death investigation, I'm fortunate in the sense that I'm there, but my medical role, or that role, is often buttressed by better resources, whereas in smaller counties, it may fall in the lap of the district attorney to be involved and take charge. And I won't go further into all the other mandates other than this was an interesting exercise for me, and again it goes to the question of size of counties to recognize that some of my colleagues in smaller counties I don't have the responsibility of the civil commitment hearings. Those are mental health hearings, and many DAs do. That's handled by my county council because of the resources of our county, but many DAs are charged with that responsibility, as well as we have to write ballot titles. There's a whole laundry list of things that, depending upon the county's resources, may fall to the less populous counties as a responsibility. Dealing with performance measures, and I will tell you straight up, this is new to us, we have identified 3. We're just beginning. We've met with the Oregon Progress Board to an attempt to figure out what it is, how we go about this process of tracking and reporting processes. We've identified, because of the state mandate in child support collections, that as being a performance measure that we believe we can address with data. Victim services, as you well know, contact with victims is an essential part of what we do, and we've got some ideas, and we'll continue working on that. A third one that we're looking at is timely responsiveness to cases, and that is how quickly do DAs process cases from the local law enforcement agencies. But I can tell you that we are, this is a work in progress, but we recognize the directive and trying to find something that is that will provide meaningful information about our functions. One of the concerns that comes up, quite frankly, is that the gathering of data and the collecting of information oftentimes has a cost to it, and of course that is one more cost that the counties have to absorb, and depending upon the size of the budget, that's an issue that we'll certainly look at in terms of the collection process. And I did include the recently discussed items because it was just items. It was just last Friday at this Chief Justice's meeting, and this was kind of an interesting item that I think is probably a more important or a more effective measure for legislators. Is we discussed the, I believe it was Mr. Ozan from Indigent Defense, suggestion initially, a performance measure that would measure the efficiency of the system, and that means the combined efforts of the courts, the DAs, and indigent defense, and that is in the timely disposition of cases. And the reality is if DAA isn't providing reports to the indigent defense, to the defense side in a timely manner, making offers in a timely manner, then the cases are going to take longer. If the courts aren't managing them effectively and efficiently, they're going to take longer. If indigent defense is dragging its heels and not providing discovery, they're going to take longer. So actually, quite frankly, I think a meaningful measure for legislators is how efficient and effective is the system, how are the players working together, and that is one that I think the committee, since it just came up Friday, we talked about it, but I think there was a general consensus that would be something that would be manageable and would be effective, so we'll continue to pursue that avenue.
Excellent. Just to give you a time check, Mr. Herman, we have seven people signed up to provide testimony, and I'd like to provide at least 4 minutes for each of those people to be able to testify. So if you could look at the next 20 minutes or so as time available.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will.
Thank you.
I'm used to the... I get the message. I'm used to the judge tapping his pen on the table. That usually is my signal to wrap it up. So, and I will. The next thing I wanted to talk about is efficiencies, and I know certainly all legislators and certainly this committee, and I know specific members of this committee have been greatly involved in the process of where can we look for efficiencies in this system, and where can we find money and save money. And sometimes I think in terms of our association, individual DAs, we bump into each other on ideas and based maybe on philosophy or our belief in how best we represent our constituents. But I thought it was important to emphasize that, as I've mentioned before, that, and again this goes to the importance of the district attorneys to the whole process, that good district attorneys, those with experience, those that work well with others, can go a long ways in creating these efficiencies with the other partners in the system. And as an example, early disposition programs, which of course the legislature has talked about for some time now, are in place throughout the state. What's very interesting is what may be an effective program in Washington County is not an effective program in another county, and we all kind of tailor our programs to our individual counties. And I think that's important, but nonetheless, that doesn't suggest that for any reason that there can't be those programs. And we put together some rough statistics, just asking DAs around the state to tell us the savings from their early disposition programs or some combination thereof. And I use this kind of, it's a very rough example, but roughly from Yamhill, Clackamas, Lane, Douglas, Multnomah, Jackson, Deschutes, Washington, and Clatsop County, we looked at ways in which the savings are roughly up $3.5 million that we believe are saved through these programs, and that's only, on my account, that's about a fourth of the district attorney's offices around the state. And what, as a DA, what I always say is a drug court or an early disposition program is only effective if it's good. You can have one, but I could stop prosecuting all child molesters and save a lot of money, but that certainly would not be what anybody would expect of the district attorney, but there are areas in each individual county that we look to, and again, I think that's the importance of DAs to the system. I mentioned drug courts, and this is a driving cost. The methamphetamine epidemic is one that drives virtually everything we do in the DA's offices these days. I mentioned dependency cases as it relates to drug courts. And setting up a drug court has a cost to it, and it's typically, as you can see from the DA's budget, salaries, deputy DA supplements, and other expenses, it comes from the counties, and it comes from the need for all the partners working together and innovation, quite frankly. I know many counties have sought, and in our county we're seeking a federal grant to support our drug courts. You look at some of these other programs, we often forget them. Bad check programs eliminates the cost of prosecution, eliminates the cost of indigent defense, and helps the local merchants. Mental health courts and some variation of that are an extreme cost to try to take people out of the system that have gotten themselves in the system but aren't really criminal in nature. And that's a significant concern. Deferred sentencing programs, community courts, I go on and on, but I guess the one point I try to say is sometimes when we're looking for dollar and cents, you know, here, what can we do to save money? It's fair to say that DAs throughout the state are constantly trying to come up with efficiencies that still allow them to manage and to do their job of protecting the citizens. And I think tooting our own horn that we are quite effective at that. I think we probably don't express that, often enough.
Mr. Herman, the early disposition survey that you referenced sounds like that was informal.
Very rough, yes.
Are you planning to survey all of the counties? Is that going to be a official document that could be provided to the committee?
Madam Chair, yes, we can ask for. We have, but we can. We can put an exclamation point by it to try to come up with some estimates. Yes, we can do that.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to skim these quickly. Major changes. That's basically funding for district attorneys has gone down over time. Pretty simply, legislation that affects us. There's a couple bills floating around. And I don't know, but an increase in witness fees, as you know, the state no longer funds witness fees, so that comes from the county. If we pay witnesses now $5 a day and 8 cents a mile, or I guess the mileage has gone up, if it goes to $20 a day, that's a significant cost that the counties will bear. And in many counties, that's going to result in something else not being done, is the bottom line. A grand jury recordation bill is just one that is a cost that the hundreds and hundreds of cases, thousands of cases that go through grand jury, someone have to pay for that. But about methamphetamines, both from terms of legislation in terms of, that's a driving cost that we've got to deal with it, and there's going to be undoubtedly legislation to deal with it, and it has a cost to it.
Speaking of that, is the association involved with the judiciary chairs as they look at all of these pieces of legislation that have been introduced and try to make a judgment about how to prioritize? Is the association playing a role in that review and screening?
Madam Chair, yes. The association came up with a kind of taking everything together with a proposal, and will work and continue to work with trying to come up with something that is workable, that gets the job done, and deals with the realities of the system.
And I hope by realities we mean enforcement and treatment.
Madam Chair, absolutely. The reality is that particularly with methamphetamine, and that's why I think you see the advent of drug courts and the effort to get them out, to stop the problem. move to Mr. Colahan very quickly, and that you can see that our initial request that didn't get past the governor reduced almost by almost $1 million request for witness fees.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lisa.
Thank you. Mr. Herman, Mr. Wilson gave us a sheet of paper and said, I'm glad that Mr. Dugan, he didn't say this, but I am glad Mr. Dugan moved up to step to Category 1, but that's based upon population. What population data do you use? Is it the census data? Is it current PSU population data?
Census data. It's current population. Madam Chair, our representative Wilson, we use the information that comes from Portland State University.
Thank you. Thank you. Madam Chair, that a lot of our programs, especially in human services, is based upon census data. And I had a bill that was going to change that so that all that would be using PSU data, and somewhere it got lost in the basement of the legislative council. But it's really a problem for counties, especially fast-growing counties like we have, that's still using 10-year-old data.
What's the bill number, Representative?
No, it never got out of council.
What's the bill number, Representative Osmond?
No, it's not. It didn't get drafted.
Oh, it didn't get drafted.
No, ma'am.
I see. We'll hold that thought.
Thank you.
Mr. Herman, did you mean to go past your legislation page?
So they have the questions.
This?
No, there's a page before that we have.
Madam Chair, I touched briefly on that. The bottom line is, anytime there's a new law, is this? As I understood this was
on witness fees, and I did hear you address methamphetamines, but I didn't hear you address grand jury recordation.
Madam Chair, that there is a bill that deals with grand jury recordation of all grand jury proceedings. I believe that's the bill I'm referring to, and that would come with it a cost that undoubtedly would be borne by the counties, be borne by someone, I presume it would be borne by the counties. Of we were compiling some numbers, and I don't have them. Mr. Dugan got those numbers of the thousands of cases that are presented weekly through the grand jury process. So that would be a significant cost one way or the other. Either the cases wouldn't go to grand jury and they would then go into the court system as a preliminary hearing, which would be an enormous cost at that end. It would be a cost either way, is our perspective on that. And it's the bottom line is the reality is any new laws or new mandates that come up through the legislature, whatever they might be, that we have to do is an additional responsibility or expense, or at least it causes us to say we're going to do this and not do that, at the county level.
Senator Devlin?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify on the witness fees. What was provided to us by Mr. Wilson would basically indicate that we have not provided DAs with witness fees since the 9901 biennium. I do not know if they were originally budgeted in the 0103 biennium and then cut in the first or second special session. I'm getting a nod of my head, but it's almost being looked at as I hate to say this with the DAs here, it's being looked at as a new expenditure.
And Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I'm not sure if I confused the issue by putting this here. This legislation I was talking about was witness fees. There's a bill that says if you are a witness, you're a subpoenaed witness, your fees would go up. Now I think it's $5, like $20 or something. And so, if that makes it clear, so we don't get any witness fees from the we don't get money to help towards witness fees from the state. We haven't. It got cut from this budget. And then there's, on top of that, there's legislation that might even increase those fees. So it's kind of like the double whammy, to say it unartfully.
Mr. Callahan, I know that you are from Burns and not available to us tomorrow, and so I do want to make the shift to you so we can take advantage of your presence, and thank you very much. Please dive in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, my comments are going to be addressed toward the policy package 101. What I want to do is to talk a little bit first about the current structuring of DAs, which determines the salaries, and then talk about the governor's proposed policy package and how that coordinates. Currently, there are four different steps, four different tiers that DAs, the 36 DAs, are placed into. This tier type of payment goes back to, as far as we can tell, 1945, and there has been some changes through the years, but the current four-tier structure has existed for 30 years plus. And as best as we can tell, in going back and working with DAS also in getting the history, the four tiers are based on the following criteria. Counties over 100,000 population are in Group 1. Group 2 were originally full-time district attorneys who also had deputy DAs. Group 3 were those full-time district attorney's offices that did not originally have deputy DAs. And once again, remember I'm talking about a structure that was created over 30 years ago. And Group 4 were the statutory part-time district attorney's offices. Policy Package 101 provides funding for a restructure of this tier system, and it would move to three tiers. It uses those historical criteria that have been used in the past. Number one, it maintains the 100,000 population for Group 1. And we think that is a recognition that counties that have populations in excess of 100,000 obviously are counties that have large urban district attorney's offices with many deputy DAs, and those DAs have a multitude of management responsibilities and supervisory tasks. The second tier is actually a regrouping that would combine existing groups 2 and 3. And really the reasons for that, as we see it, is that it's a recognition of the increased responsibilities of district attorneys. It's a recognition, number one, that all full-time district attorneys in Oregon, except for one, we believe, and that is Lake County, now have deputy DAs. It's also a recognition that because of victims' rights legislation that's passed, all full-time district attorney's offices now have a full-time director of their victim services program. And it's also, I think, a recognition of the unique role that Mr. Herman has talked about that the DA plays in the criminal justice system. The DA as a part of the state government is probably it's probably the most unique agency, if you may, that will come before the subcommittee, I would imagine, because we are, as has been indicated, we're 36 full-time equivalents who are each independently elected. We are all serve as department heads for county departments. We are paid to be good managers. We are paid to make good decisions in the criminal justice system. When we do that, when we make good decisions as DAs in the criminal justice system, we save the state money. And I think this restructuring will go far to not only attract experienced career prosecutors, but also retain career experienced prosecutors in the small to medium-sized district attorney's offices. The policy packages, it also recognized the importance of the position of the district attorney and the importance of the DA in working with all the agencies. And that is a very brief description of policy package 101. If there's any questions.
Comments or questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Real quick, thank you, Mr. Callahan. So I guess because of Lake, that would have been Group 3, and Group 3 would have been 4. That's all we changed, really, because the other counties you're saying there had deputies. Is that's
Madam Chair, Representative Wismuth, that's correct. What the new three-tier system would do would collapse two into three, and it's part of that is a recognition that all full-time DAs now have deputy DAs, except for one county, which it's our understanding he's actually seeking funding to hire a deputy DA through grants.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wismuth.
And what are the three DAs that do not have, or that are part-time? What counties?
The part-time DAs are Gillum County, Sherman County, and Wheeler County.
Thank you.
What is your position or the position of the organization, the DA's organization, regarding pay equity, equity as it relates to the defense side, indigent defense, mm-hmm. and looking at a balance that we would desire to have in our system?
But, Madam Chair, in fact, we do have a slide that shows the differences between state funding for indigent defense, for district attorneys, and for the judicial department. Obviously, that graph shows a number of things. One thing it shows probably most brightly is the fact that the state has a very small financial support of DAs. Basically, our salaries compose the vast majority of the DA's budget. The counties supply virtually 93% of the rest of our budgets. So there has been an increase, as that slide shows, for the other departments. Right now,
hold it just for a moment. The slide being represented to us represents salaries only?
No, Madam Chair, that's total budgets.
Right, so if we, my favorite expression, unpacked that piece to look at salaries, just salaries,
mm-hmm.
Judicial, public defense side, and DA's, what would we see? Do you have a slide that reveals that, or do we need to create one?
We do not, Madam Chair. We don't have a slide that would reveal that.
Let's take a look at that.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. I mean, judicial department salaries are relatively easy to ascertain.
Mm-hmm.
Public defense services many times are paid on contract. But I think we could probably get an idea. I'm getting Mr. Ozan to shake his head, so we can probably put something together. Like
that would be very helpful.
Madam Chair, I think just speaking out loud here for a moment, what it probably would show, obviously, is that circuit court judges are all paid the same salary. DAs are not. Circuit court judges all make approximately $96,000 a year. DAs, and there's only one DA in each county, obviously, are paid on a four-tier system. So, and that is something that has been addressed by prior reports to the legislature going back clear to the 70s, that there is some merit in looking at a restructuring of the DA salaries and perhaps even tying them to circuit court judges.
Okay. Mr. Callahan, did you have additional information that you wanted to present? Again, I'm looking at needing to shift to our public testimony, but I don't want to cut you off if there's additional information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate that. And no, I have nothing more to add. There will be some public testimony of some other district attorneys and offices that will be discussing Policy Package 101. But unless there are any other questions, I have nothing more to add.
Thank you. Thank you very much for making the trip over from Burns. Have a pleasant drive going back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Mr. Herman, we appreciate your participation as well, and we'll be hearing more from you later.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And looking at our witness registration, it is our practice to hear testimony from those who traveled more than 100 miles. And so I have three people in that category: Gary Williams, Walt Biglow.
Ma'am, I'm from
Marion
County right here.
Okay.
Probably traveled shorts.
All right. Okay. Gary Williams and Dan Norris, if they would come forward.
with the chair's indulgence, I think we can wait. I think there were some other people who had some more important things to say than us, and if there's time, we would be glad to go.
You might want to catch your moment right now and not pass on it. You traveled quite a distance to be here, and we're glad that you did.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on in terms of the restructuring package.
In about 3 minutes.
Yeah, and I'll introduce myself. I'm Dan Norris. I'm the district attorney for Malibu County. Representative Wisman, you asked specifically how did we get to this train. When we started in territorial days, and I'm with Representative Hansen, I wasn't here, but I understand what happened from the Constitution, is the state paid 100% of the district attorney's salaries. As we grew as a state, we ended up with deputy DAs because the workload could not be handled by one person. And counties began to take over some of that burden. We went from territorial days when the state paid 100% of the district attorney's salaries to the boat we're in now, where the state contributes about 7% of the cost of prosecuting criminals in this state. And so in response to your question, why is the state funding locally elected district attorneys? The counties asked me that same question. Why are the counties funding the prosecution of state crimes? As the home of the second largest city in Niagara County is Snake River Correctional Institution. 3,000 convicted felons, most of whom live elsewhere or came from elsewhere when they came, and about 1,100 to 1,500 employees. When I go into my county budget board, they ask me every single time, why are you spending county resources prosecuting offenders from outside of the state? And I respond in all earnestness, because everybody deserves to be safe at work, and the punishment for committing a crime is prison, not that you're assaulted within that prison, and victims deserve to have justice. And they ask me, what's the state doing to help ease the burden? And I tell them, we have a policy package. We are asking the state for almost $10 million to help with this pot of money to prosecute crimes. If the pot of money that the state contributes is reduced, what we end up doing is we ask the state, or we ask the counties, to contribute more, because someone has to pay for the prosecution of those crimes. That includes the salaries for my deputy DAs, includes my salary, and frankly, I am one of the people who would benefit from this restructuring. But when I started in this business 15 years ago, I had an office of one district attorney, a deputy DA, myself, and a clerical staff. At this point, I have 4 deputy DAs, myself, and 15 total employees that I supervise. And when we look at the tier restructuring, that is why the DAS recommendation and the governor's recommendation is that a restructure is the appropriate way to deal with the issue. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I comment real quick?
Certainly.
Thank you for those comments. And, you know, my position is that your situation is unique, and I'm having a problem with a lot of the state formulas for funding, and that we've got alcohol and drug abuse, and Deschutes County gets $3 per person, and other counties get $17 a person. You've got a situation where, because of the prison there, you're helping the state. Those are state people, and it should be based upon need, and that's what I'm trying to force people to look at. Let's fund things according to the need and the actual work, not by a population or a general type. Every county gets it, and that's so. I appreciate your comments, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Chair Gordley, and members of the subcommittee. My name is Gary Williams, and I'm the district attorney in Prineville in Crook County. I would like to respond to some questions that I have heard members of the subcommittee ask today. Representative Wisnant asked about state funding of salaries for district attorneys. And I would like to report that we are state elected officials. We file in Salem as opposed to in our local jurisdictions. We represent all of the people of the state of Oregon. We advocate for the rights of all of the people of the state of Oregon. We protect rights of victims throughout the state of Oregon. And so we are not county attorneys. There are county attorneys in most of our counties, and they are paid by the county, but we are not county attorneys as such. Representative Wisnant also asked about most recent pay raise That was a 2% pay raise on January 1st of 2001. And my memory is that was a pay raise that was the same shared by other state employees. It was not a special pay raise
to prosecutors. Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, I think it's actually statute says that the DAs get the same cost of living increases as any other management employee in the state of Oregon. What they do not get, if I'm not mistaken, is merit increases like other state employees do. So there is a difference there.
Right, and we have that's been the last raise that management service, or at least we have received. I don't know if there have been other raises given to other state employees or management service employees in the state since then, but we have not received those. Representative Hannah asked about how many cases we appear on in dependency cases. I can answer in Crook County we appear on 100%. Of the juvenile dependency cases that are filed, and I think that's common. Representative Hansen suggested that the DAs in smaller counties are perhaps not as busy as those in larger counties, if I understood that correctly. And my comment to that is that in the larger counties, the workload is spread among more assistance, and so
what I meant was that the total cases vary dramatically from county to county. I'm sure that somebody in a smaller county that's working by himself is working just as hard as somebody in a big county with a lot of assistance.
Yes, I believe that's true. There was also a suggestion that the district attorneys in the smaller counties are paid pretty well, but not so well in the larger counties. The smaller counties' district attorneys are paid $67,500 per year. That's state salary. And for lawyers who have a considerable experience, some up to 30 years' experience, and expertise in a very specific area of the law, such as criminal law, and who have considerable skill and experience in budget law and budget preparation and office administration and employment law and in federal and state constitutional law and juvenile law, child support enforcement, trial skills, negotiation principles and practices, public relations, developing partnerships with private and public agencies, and who make decisions every day that affect the lives of people forever, perhaps $67,000 per year is not considered by many to be a well-paid salary level. Thank you.
Thank you, yes. And thank you both for making the trip over. We really appreciate it. Thank you. Mike Schrump and John Foot.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Schrunk, the District Attorney in Multnomah County. I am not one of the beneficiaries from this. I would quick to point that out to you in the sense of dollars and cents, but I am one of the beneficiaries in the fact that if you accept this policy package, we will increase the quality of district attorneys and enable men and women across the state to continue in public service, public prosecution. I've been a district attorney for over two decades in Multnomah County, and when I first, not as long as Commissioner Hansen, I don't go back that far, but when I first became the district attorney, I looked at the way the pay structure of the elected district attorneys was, and I couldn't really understand it. I talked to some of the older people, and I finally figured it out, and I thought, well, there's a whole lot of people that are being underpaid. And in the 20-plus years I've been district attorney, I've met really some fine men and women that have enhanced the quality of life in their various communities, not only in prosecution, but in civic activities, collaboration with county, city, state, and federal agencies. You've really done a good job. We've seen the demographics change in the state of Oregon during that 20-year period. We've not changed this structuring. We've come, and I've served a time as president of this association, like Mr. Herman is doing today, and we argued, we presented, and we lobbied to change the structure, to raise the salaries. And this is probably the best chance that we have. Last session, we were told that we'll come up with something different. And we debated this within the association, and we presented the policy package to you, it's package 101. And I'm here to urge you to accept it and to go with it. It allows us to keep high quality men and women in the 36 various counties. Does this hurt counties? Yes, it does when you lose men and women. You heard Gary Williams tell you that $67,000. You look at what someone bouncing out of law school is making right now at some of your silk stocking firms and even some of your medium firms in the metropolitan areas and not just the Portland area, in the Deschutes County area, in the Eugene area, the Salem area. And we are on the verge of losing a lot of good men and women. This structure, there is a cost. It's a minimal cost, but I would urge you to look at it as a sound investment in good governance in the state of Oregon, and it will enhance and benefit all of the citizens of the state. Thank you.
Ask a question?
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, what's the average tenure of a district attorney? How many terms have they served on average?
I don't know. I thought I would probably serve when I was elected three or four terms and then go off and do something else. I found it. I liked it. So I can't tell you. I can tell you the average tenure of something I am familiar with of a deputy district attorney, and that's vitally important, although that's a county funding operation. When I took over the office, it was 2.8 years, and my commitment was not to have a political office, but to have a professional office, one where men and women could grow and get good professional experience. I now have the average tenure of 12.8 years. I have a professional office. I'm proud of it. Representative Hansen was one of my commissioners at one time, and he contributed with the support of his other colleagues on the board at that time to that. And I think it's important when you're dealing with the law that changes, you don't have to continually reinvent the wheel in each community with each different dynamic that comes in with each variation. Let me make a pitch. I believe district attorneys ought to be reflective of the individual community they serve, and they ought to be responsive to that community. And I think this is the type of men and women that you get when you take care of them with a pay structure, and they become vested in that community. They become community leaders, much as you are community leaders in your own right as legislators, as representatives and senators. It's vital that there be an interest. And again, this is why this policy package makes good sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to have to slip out. I've got, so I just want to make one comment before I went out the door. We've talked a lot this session about the meth crisis, and I think there's something like 90 bills pending to try it. One of the reasons we have a meth crisis is because we've underfunded our system for many years. So that the system, when the pressures of methamphetamines came along, the system couldn't react to it and couldn't react quickly. So this, I look at this policy package as one of those, almost like an infrastructure system building block that we need to do in order to make make the system work, and it almost is another one of the math bills. I mean, if we've got good, strong district attorney offices that are adequately funded and sized for each county, our ability to respond, you know, all the way across, both in things like parental neglect hearings, methamphetamine, whatever, we're going to be a stronger state for it and better able to cope. Anyway, and the county commission was very proud of our district attorney's office too while I was there. I noticed that when you were listing reactions or interface with other groups, county commissions weren't on that list, but that may have been Freudian. That was Bob's idea.
Yeah, that was Mr. Herman's. County commission and the legislative contingent.
Yeah, we didn't make that list.
Thank you, Representative Hanson. We'll see you over in Tillamook this evening.
Where we're headed.
Mr. Foote.
Good afternoon, Chair Gordley. Members of the committee, I'm going to make my comments even briefer. Everything Mike just said, I agree with. What's interesting is that this support for this package is throughout the ODAA and not just those that are subject to being moved. Mike and I are two people. Bob is another behind me, and Walt Bedlow, and the five big counties aren't changing, but we think this is good public policy for the reasons Mike just said. We want to make sure that we have good people in these offices, and sometimes the biggest challenges are in the small counties. So this is a good thing to do. We think it's the right thing to do. A couple other things I want to say real quickly. A big picture from where I sit, and I've been in the system about 25 years. These are state offices that aren't state funded. On a big picture now, and except on a very small scale, and we think that that there is a partnership between the county and the state in our offices particularly, and we think this is actually, to be quite honest, we think the partnership should be stronger than just this package, but because witness fees are gone and Deputy DA supplements are virtually gone when you divide 701,000 into 36 counties. So we'd like that partnership to be smaller, to be stronger, and this is just one step in that process, we think. There were some questions about the process in dependency cases. It was a while ago, I know, but I just wanted to bring up one small point on that, and that is district attorneys don't have clients. We're different than other lawyers. And that comes into play with victims. It comes into play in a lot of different places. It comes into play in juvenile court. And what that allows us to do is to pursue what we think is right and to not be just bound by what a client may want us to do. And that has ramifications throughout the system and I think makes us very useful in all sorts of places, including juvenile court. We're not anchored the way some lawyers are to an agency or to a client. And finally, there was some conversation, Chair Burley, about the closing of the state hospital. Something just affected one of our cases that I wanted to bring up, and that is I understand that the juvenile wing in the state hospital has been closed, and that has caused great concern in my office, and I bet it caused great concern in offices that are not aware of it. Particularly, this had to do with a case that we prosecuted about a year ago, a young person who shot a police officer, Damon Coates, who's permanently disabled and badly injured. That defendant was 17 and severely mentally ill and violent. There was a proposal at his hearing recently to put him out in the community, well, in a less restrictive environment, and we were very concerned about it. The underlying drive for that was a closure of the juvenile facility at the state hospital, which we think is a big mistake. This is not the forum to deal with that, but I wanted to go on the record about it. Nobody wants to see mentally ill people incapacitated any more than they have to be, but we also don't want to place them in the community in danger by putting people out who shouldn't be out. And the danger in just closing the facility is that's what happens. And that happened in this case, we believe. We hope nothing happens in the future as a result of that, and we'd like to see that addressed in some way, not just the adult system, but also the juvenile. So thank you for listening to that.
And I hope that you also took note of my earlier encouragement to connect with Mr. Nickel in
yes.
the Department of Human Services and explore how you can get your voice and concerns injected into that process. And to my friend, Mike, D.A. Schrock, great to see you. We've gone through a lot of challenges over the years, and it's just great to see you today. Thanks
I think we're better for it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks
Excuse
for coming
me,
down.
Senator.
Good to see you, friend. Calling up next, Walt, these are the last three folks. Walt Biglow, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name earlier. Paul Snyder and Peter Ozan. And looks like we've got about 7 minutes, 7 or 8 minutes for you all to share.
If I may, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walt Biglow, and I'm the Marion County District Attorney. I'm here to express my support for the District Attorney budget. I'm a relatively newly appointed District Attorney, but I want to highlight the collective commitment of the district attorneys to public safety. By way of example, I have been fairly active participant in the District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee, and I have been witness to a collaborative consensus-building effort to stem the methamphetamine epidemic that we have here in our state. And like other issues in public safety, I believe the electeds are truly driven to do what's best for Oregonians, and their willingness to send out ambassadors to literally any conference table to talk through these issues. Let me speak specifically, though, Chair, to methamphetamine. And I want to give you a slice of Marion County. In just about 100 yards in every community except heading towards the river, you will find dozens of children living in meth-infested homes. It's 90% of my business as a common denominator. We have seen exponential growth in our deliveries, in our mistreatments of kids, in inappropriate physical care. We had 1 8-year-old boy we just pulled out of a house that could recite an exacting recipe for methamphetamine like he had been taught that recipe in school. Of the total possessions of user amounts in Marion County last year, I filed 887 total, all drugs. 801 were methamphetamine, and my managers tell me, oh, meth was involved in the other ones as well. We just had more heroin or cocaine. The association has taken a concerted effort to come up with an alignment with the community. And I believe we have come forward with a balanced proposal that looks at a balanced way to tackle this problem through treatment programs and the local look that you've got to have with your drug courts and the treatment model to break the crippling addiction. We are looking at the enforcement mechanisms on folks that are repeat offenders or who we really want to get out, which are manufacturing here in our communities. That's the model, and I believe we need to move forward. One idea, I just want to make sure it's tossed out there, we could attach an assessment to those convicted of delivering or manufacturing and use that as a pool of dollars then to stem back to our counties in an effort to fund drug courts or other efforts in a community alignment way. Two other points, and I'm done. I just wanted to respond about law enforcement and training, in particular with the state police. Just in May, we're going to be sitting down with our forensics folks to talk about court system and make sure they understand the court system and how to get in evidence and work with them. So we are doing that locally, and I know the DAs are statewide. As far as our sworn officers, it's tirelessly. We meet nights, weekends, training and in-service trainings and with the reserved deputies all the time, and I know that's a statewide. I just want to make sure, Madam Chair, that you knew that, and working real hard on that. And witness fees, finally. Currently, witness fees are 8 cents a mile for any witness reimbursed by the counties through their general fund and $5 per witness. That includes grand juries, court appearances. The bill that's out there is to increase that to 25 I think, 25 cents and for $30 per witness. And I can just assure you that would decimate the general fund material and service budgets of your counties. In fact, when I looked at it, I generated the numbers. It's a 500% increase. It would wipe out my entire fund. I could barely buy the paper to print indictments on. And so I just wanted to bring forward that concept there that when you make that, that's a huge impact to us as prosecutors to be able to do our job. So thank you for the opportunity to make a few comments today.
Thank you, and thank you for your service. Mr. Snyder, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. And we support the governor's proposed budget as presented to the subcommittee, including the compensation package that the district attorneys are advancing. Back until 1985, prosecution witness fees were an expense paid by the state. That year, the statute was changed to make it a county responsibility, but in the same bill, the legislature appropriated about $380,000 of state funds to offset those costs. Now we've reached the point where prosecution witness fees are borne totally by the counties. In 1999 and again in 2001, the Attorney General issued a couple of reports regarding district attorney financing. It was done in conjunction with ODAA and AOC. In those reports, the Attorney General recommended that the state move incrementally in the direction of being an equal partner and bearing the costs, 50-50, 50% counties, 50% state. In that report, it indicated that the state share of total prosecution costs had moved from about 19% in the year 1976 down to about 9% in the year 2001. And I thought at the time, boy, that's a pretty unpleasant number. I didn't know that 4 years later I'd be looking back at the year 2001 saying, you know, it wasn't as bad as it's getting now. I recognize that the state is in a difficult financial situation, and we all are as well. We have accepted what the governor has proposed in terms of deputy DA supplement. It's not much, but at least it's still a line item that's in the budget. We hope to come back to you in a future biennium when circumstances are better for all of us and dust off some of these reports and the reasons that the Attorney General gave for those recommendations. But this isn't the session to do it. In the meantime, we agree and believe that it's a very, very valuable investment to make in the district attorney himself or herself because of the central role that the district attorney plays in the local criminal justice system to provide adequate compensation to attract talented people. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Snyder. Good afternoon, Mr. Ozan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Ozan. I'm Executive Director of the Public Defense Services Commission. We're the folks who typically on the other side of cases with my colleagues in the bar here in the room, but I am here for really two reasons. One, to demonstrate, I think, what's been happening. I wouldn't necessarily call it a new day, but I hope it's certainly a new leaf, and that you can be assured that the Public Defense Services Commission and myself are working closely with people like Mr. Herman. He mentioned we've met together. We're looking at cost efficiencies in the area of early disposition programs. We're looking at performance measures. We know we have to be strong advocates in the courtroom, but there's no reason whatsoever that we can't work together as policymakers and as assistants to you in developing good public safety policy. So I've made that speech. I believe it, but it doesn't surprise you. I wanted to speak. I got called last night by a representative here to come, so I can't speak for the commission, but I can speak as a private citizen and perhaps someone who likes to assist this committee. I know the committee is very knowledgeable about all of this. 35 years ago, when I was about to go into practice, several of my law professors told me, what you really need to do is be a prosecutor. They're the ones that have the power in the legal system, in the criminal justice system, the power for good and the power for ill, the power for change. It's taken me some years. It took me 25 years before I wound up in a federal prosecutor's office, but it became quite clear to me. The men and women who do this work have most of the power in the system. Bar none, in my opinion, including the judges, particularly when we have systems like ballot measure 11, guideline systems, which give a huge amount of discretion to the men and women in the prosecutor's offices. So, in my humble opinion, we're moving in the wrong direction in Oregon. I very much recognize the difficulties you're facing, and as Mr. Snyder just said, this isn't the biennium to solve them. But if we want a sensible public safety system, we have to have the very best men and women among in the legal ranks to fill these positions of elected district attorneys. I think it's scary as a private citizen to think that the leadership in the offices, and we all know the difficulties of payment for elected officials, but the leaders of the offices are regularly underpaid compared to the senior deputies in the offices to get good people. If you want to get the very best people to do this important work, we in Oregon have to pay more. And so I think the direction of reduced support for elected district attorneys in the long run, recognizing, and I can't speak to the details of these budgets, I'm not knowledgeable about them, and I don't know the trade-offs, but in the long run, going in the direction of reduced contributions for the elected district attorneys is a bad idea. I won't take any of your time about parity. I believe it's a two-way street. We in the defense community, our salaries are lower in some areas, particularly in the large jurisdictions, but there are places where district attorneys and deputy district attorneys are probably paid less, as best I can determine, than the contractors in indigent defense. So we need to level all boats in that regard, and I welcome that discussion. I think in general, when you look at Mr. Williams saying a district attorney in, I guess, a tier two is paid $67,000 with 20, 30 years experience, and last I checked with my colleagues in my law firm, we were paying people $85,000 fresh out of law school who didn't know anything. So, you can't expect to draw the talent long-term that we need in these district attorney's offices. And then, secondly, to key off some things that Mr. Foote, Mr. Williams, and Mr. Snyder said, these district attorneys, though elected in the counties, are state officials bound to enforce state law. And by the way, they do probably more than defense attorneys, in my opinion, to protect the Constitution and the citizens, because they are at the first place when educating the police, checking legality of lineups, and so forth. But these district attorneys are state officials. And I think if we're going to have a system, as we've talked about in my sessions and in many others, a true public safety system, we should have more state funding for this important ingredient. I'm just talking about begging for dollars. I'm talking about bringing coherence to the system. If you've got multiple counties, it's already, everybody seems to be an elected official, and I applaud that in a democracy. That makes difficulties. But if you have counties and states running the system, it isn't really going to be a system, in my opinion. So I think the direction the state has to go, and it seems to me we're going in the opposite direction, is to step in and more fully fund the prosecution function. I recognize all the other demands on money in the state, and I recognize your difficulties, but in terms of good public safety policy, we have to pay elected officials more money, and I think the state has to step up and fund the prosecution function. And as you know, of course, because you fund me and my colleagues, we pay attention. We pay attention to what your policies are. If you didn't pay me any money, I'd be a little more independent and probably disregard the policies of the legislature. So it doesn't matter what component it is, you won't have a system unless the state contributes substantially to the function. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Roseanne. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And colleagues, on Thursday, the schedule calls for the completion of the agency presentation and public testimony for the Criminal Justice Commission, the work session for the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision is also scheduled for Thursday.
We, Madam Chair,
Representative,
do we have more detail on the option than the amount of money or how it's, where's the option, the option package 101? I didn't see.
I'm not sure. I mean, the option package that's in the governor's budget, I believe, is $492,000. And I think I mentioned in my write-up that if you were to do what the report to the E-Board by just raising the four counties into Tier 1, I think there's one county moving between 3 and 2, was, I think, $167,000 would have been, you know, another option that was looked at.
what you were looking for.
Yeah, but are they, is it saying that they're going to, someone talked about how the district attorneys in the big county should be the same as judges or whatever, which is 97,000. What are we, I mean.
I'd have to look at.
I don't know what we're voting on. I mean,
at this juncture, we're not voting. We're just trying to understand. Your question is an excellent one. Let's pick up there when we.
There's no detail to
when we come back, and we will do that. Representative was not without any. If there are no other comments, then we adjourn.